I'm Tom Morello,
host of Maximum Firepower,
a weekly podcast focusing on the music, the moments, and the movements that have shaped my worldview and left an indelible mark on me as an artist and activist.
Come correct with Maximum Firepower.
Redwood Forest, Gulf Stream waters.
This land was made for you and me.
This is Tom Morello's Maximum Firepower.
So I'm Tom Morello. This is Maximum Firepower. My good friends and guitar virtuoso Steve Vise with me. Steve, it's so lovely to see you. What's going on?
Oh, it's so nice. Thanks for the invitation.
Yeah, of course. We've discussed this in person, but now I've been a fan of yours for a very, very long time. The first time where your name came across my young guitar player grid was there was a flexi disc in a guitar magazine of your song Blue Powder. And, you know, and I ripped it out of the magazine and put it on my 45 player and really could. I mean, it was a revelatory moment. It's like when it was a revelatory moment where I just heard something that just was beyond, it outflanked the parameters of what I thought guitar playing, both in sort of style and substance and kind of from sort of a sonic adventurousness to a emotional depth in a piece. It was really like stunning as someone who was, I was in the middle of my practicing 8 hours a day, and it really was a tremendous, that flexi disc was a tremendous inspiration. So do you remember that at all? Like that?
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. I remember it because I had originally recorded Blue Powder as a demo for a Carvin X100B amp because it was the first stack that I ever owned. They gave it to me because I couldn't really afford anything way back then.
Yeah.
So I did my best, and the song just kind of, you know, I thought in doing that and all the other stuff, the solo work back then, I kind of felt like what I was doing was just my own little secret, that no one was really going to ever hear it. I can do whatever I want.
Yeah.
You know, it's not Dave Roth. It's not this. Yeah. So I was very kind of open. And a song like Blue Powder, that was just a stream of consciousness. You know, the chords and the melody just came right out. And then I recorded that. And at the time, they were doing these little promos in the Guitar Player magazine. But to imagine that it would make its way to you and have that kind of reception.
Yes, yes.
It's quite a surprise.
Yeah, in my apartment on Normandy here, I had just moved to LA and it was, and anyway, so that was when I first heard your name. Then I did some research. There was no internet researching, but then, you know, I learned of your work with Frank Zappa. And it's like, at the time, you know, I was like a heavy metal and punk rock person. And Frank Zappa was really not on my radar. And I did listen to some of that, and I was just sort of amazed at one sort of like the quirky brilliance of Frank's sort of lyrical vision, and then and what felt to me almost like a mismatched way, the musical complexity that accompanied it was just
mismatched,
which is crazy. And I'm like, oh, and he's the guitar player doing that stuff. So anyway, and then of course the Eat 'Em and Smile. So all of us, you know, those of us who were heavy metal gunslingers at the time, you know, Eddie Van Halen, of course, was on the pillar, and the band breaks apart, and we think like this is the end, this is the end of good guitar playing on records as we know it. And then Diamond Dave surprises everybody. And I remember like seeing a preview to the record. I was like, that's the Blue Powder guy. There's a chance. Like there's a chance. And then, you know, revelation number two was hearing Eddie, of course, we all had on a pedestal, and there's no possible way someone can fit in those shoes. And while you didn't try to fit in those shoes, you created boots of your own equal size that satisfied all of us who loved, you know, that vibe and that style. So tell me a little bit about like that moment, that moment in time.
It's a very touching way of putting it. Thank you. I think you nailed it. The odd thing to me was, since you know my background, I'm not a conventional kind of a rock metal player. Mm-hmm. There's some very quirky. I think that quirkiness is my strength.
Yep.
I think that's one of the reasons Dave was attracted, because Dave's kind of quirky, you know? And when the phone rang, well, when I heard that Dave was putting a band together, the moment I heard that, something just said to me, that's your gig.
Yeah.
Not that it was like, you know, I want that gig. I've got to beat everybody. There was nothing like that. It was just this little voice that said, whether you want it or not, that's your gig.
This
it's
is
coming.
The future. Yeah.
Yeah, it's coming. And then, you know, like clockwork, a day later, the phone rings or whatever. And it's Dave Roth. And I just thought, there it is, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, and of course I was enamored with Edward. He was just, you know, so I didn't even register the idea of trying to compete with him because that's just foolish, you know. And plus, I couldn't. And also, I just liked what I was doing.
Yes, yeah. You know? Yeah.
I kind of like thought, okay, great. This is a, because there's all this quirky side to me and all this muso stuff. But there's, you know, I grew up on Led Zeppelin.
Yeah.
You know, and Kiss and all the great, great rock music of the 70s. That was my juice.
Yeah.
So this was a great opportunity. I just knew it. I saw it and I said, okay, I know. I love Edward, but can't go there.
Yeah. And the one thing that came across was so surprised, you know, for fans of what had happened and what was about to happen in the Yankee Rose video, which was the introduction to the planet. And I'm like, this guy is now stepping into the spot on stage that was previously handled by Edward Van Halen.
I know
that. And he's not scared. Like, that's what I thought when I saw him. I was like, that guy's just rocking me. Like he's assuming I'm coming right along for this ride because he's there. And I'm like, I was like, and I am.
Well, that's a real interesting, that's a very interesting way to put it, because I actually felt that way. But I have to say, and you know, it's always hard to search your own heart, you know, but I felt that way. I actually felt that the fans, you don't compare anybody to Edward.
That's right. Yeah.
You know, just this guy here that's up there now is just who he is, and he's just offering something else.
That's right.
I like it or I don't.
Yeah. But what you were offering had, it was different enough, and it had an entirely different sort of spectrum and of its own colors that was in the mind of my, it was like, it was equal to, it wasn't like they got the guy from Autograph. No disrespect to Autograph. But anyway, like there were a lot of players who played like Eddie Van Halen at the time, and Dave didn't plug one of those guys in. He found someone with his own unique and powerful artistic vision that was now in that world of, you know, and it was fantastic. So tell me if this story is true, because I remember reading it at the time. So that record comes out and now it's a thing, and now you are known. You are no longer the Berkeley student and the Frank Zappa flexi disc guy. You're the guitar playing man. Was there a moment where you walked into the Rainbow Bar and Grill, the hallowed heavy metal establishment on the Sunset Strip, where at the, you know, ground zero for all things rock and roll and metal, and like you walked in and there was like a standing ovation? Did that happen?
Yeah, that's so awesome.
Dude.
It was bizarre, you know, because you're right. Back then in the 80s, the Rainbow was just like the go-to hang.
Yeah.
You know, and I lived right around the corner when I first moved here.
Yeah.
You know, right on Fairfax. But I wasn't so much part of that scene.
Right.
Entirely.
Right.
Yeah. You know, I dabbled in it.
Yeah.
I didn't know what to expect.
Yeah.
You know?
And well, everybody in that scene had that record, and everybody in that scene who had that record had the same reaction that I had.
Well, that I came to discover that later. And it was so interesting because I was in Dave's basement for like a year and completely sheltered from any of this.
Yeah.
And it didn't hit me until the record actually came out and I would go out.
Yeah.
I mean, the first thing that happened, this is, you'll get a kick out of this. I go to the gym like I've been doing for years, same gym, and the record's out and I'm walking through the parking lot and there's this guy that's screaming through the parking lot in his car, you know? And he has to stop and his brakes screech and he beeps the horn and he's got the music blasting. He's jamming to the music and he beeps the horn and he looks at me and he screams some profanity, "You asshole," or something like that. And I just look at him and go, "Oh, dude," you know? He's listening to Eat 'Em and Smile.
You're like, I'm like, who's the asshole? Like, you're
Yeah. And then when we got to, you know, the energy of an arena.
Yeah.
You know the energy of a stadium.
Yeah. I mean, I saw you on that tour. I saw you guys at the Forum on that tour. I saw you at the Forum on that tour. I was in the last row and I enjoyed it tremendously.
Well, it was great. I mean, you know, for me at that age, at that time, I mean, it was just amazing.
Yeah,
it was totally amazing.
Yeah.
I played the part. You know, I played the part. I wore the clothes. I acted the part.
Yeah.
I maneuvered. I was a total,
You had
I was a total pseudo rock star. You
had the hair for it.
I had the hair, everything.
You had all of that in spades. Yeah. Okay, so the next thing I want to talk about is the Passion of Warfare record, because that was really, you know, that and sort of Surfing with the Alien, the Joe Satriani record, it was really kind of like the high water mark of like sort of the commercial acclaim of solo instrumental guitar players. I mean, sort of there had been a Jeff Beck wave before, and guitar players enjoyed the Yngwie Malmsteen record and whatnot, but these were like gold or platinum record. I'm not sure, but it was they were records that were heavily promoted, you know, to the world in competitive, in like a pop way, in a, you know, in a rock way. And for a record that is that sort of great and challenging musically, I mean, it's a musician's record, right? Yeah. It's very much a musician's record that is like unapologetic in its Steve Vai-ness without.
That's a good way of putting it.
You know what I mean? Like, I mean, there's the one song that's like a little Hot for Teacher style, which might've been the singular song. There's something that's a little bit got one foot in the world of this is something not totally removed from what you might see
was
on
a bit
MTV.
Of a piss take on Van Halen.
But the record as a whole is really a, like, you feel the artist's soul in that record. You know what I mean? And for that to sell a million copies. So tell me a little bit about that record. But the one thing I want to ask about specifically is another Steve Vai rumor, which I hope is true. And please tell me it is, even if it's not, is that for some of the, either, I'm not sure whether it was For the Love of God or for Blue Powder or something, that you actually did fasting before the recordings of the songs. Like there needed to be some sort of spiritual cleansing before you got your humbuckers going. I'd like to hear about that. That's fascinating to me. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, when I look at my career, it was a series of perfect storms. You know, things took place in perfect timing to kind of unfold this quirky, weird career of mine. And when Passion and Warfare came out, there was so much momentum. I had had the Attitude song made a big splash, the Crossroads, the David Lee Roth. I mean, all of these things were like adding up. And at that point, I knew that I was sort of giving myself to a particular side of my muse, you know, the particular side of the music I like, but I was depriving myself of this other side, this quirky musical that had all these melodies and visions and things like that. And at one point when I left Dave Roth's band, I just decided, you know what it's like. You just have to do this.
Yes, I do.
Have to do it. And I actually, at one point, I made a conscious decision that this is going to be probably going to be the end of my career. Mm-hmm. Because it's not Dave Roth. It's not all this big stuff.
It's not White Snake.
It's none of this stuff. Yeah, yeah, yeah. But I have to do it. Mm-hmm. So that's where the unapologeticness came in. There was nothing to lose.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, it was just like, nobody's going to care.
Right, right.
No, what does anybody care what this guy is doing? Yeah.
It's a great place to create from and to make art from. It's a great place to create from, yeah.
It's the best place because there's freedom in it, you know? Yeah. So when I made the record and it came out, I actually thought, this is the end of my career. I can't tour. I can't do anything.
Yeah, yeah.
But I had joined Whitesnake. Mm-hmm. So I was actually on tour with Whitesnake when the record came out. And I remember I was, I think it was in Toronto, and I was in a radio station and I was going up. I was in the building and I was going up to the, I don't know, whatever floor.
Yeah.
And I met this guy in the lobby. And this is a week after the record came out. And he says, hey, congratulations. I heard that your record's number 18 with a bullet and it went gold already. And I absolutely was convinced that this guy had no idea what he was talking about.
The Whitesnake record or something. Yeah.
Yeah. Or he was talking to the wrong person. He didn't even know who I was, you know? And I just went, oh, yeah, cool, thanks. And then I go up and I sit down and the guy turns the mic on. And the first thing the DJ says is, what does it feel like to have a record that's 18 with a bullet and has gone gold in the first week? And I was like, what? I couldn't, what?
Yeah.
So that was a real surprise. But yeah, I used to, there was a period that I went through this great metaphysical sort of revival, you know, and I was studying spirituality. I was hanging out at the Bodhi Tree bookstore and I was doing all these things because I came from a place of some real mental challenges and I needed to go through a complete transformation. And I found all this great stuff and I got very heavily into it, especially back in the flexible days. Mm-hmm. And then with Passion and Warfare, you could see, like, even in the liner notes and stuff, there's all this mystic kind
Yes.
But there was some things that, I mean, I was serious about it at the time. I mean, I was doing intense, cognizant dream recollection and astral projection studies and this kind of thing. And one of the other things I did, I needed to get my health together. Before I was, I gave it precious little attention. So one of the books I came across was The Miracle of Fasting by Paul Bragg. I think that's his name. And I read this book and I became very into it and I started to fast. I started once a week and then twice a year for 10 days at a time. Because it does, you know, I wouldn't recommend just doing it. I mean, I studied it. Mm-hmm. And it was fascinating and actually phenomenal what it does to you, how it changes your mental state. Of course, there's a difference between a fast that you do for yourself for health benefits and starving.
Right.
You know, being in a situation where you're just, you know, being malnutritioned. This is very different, you know. So this was for health benefits. And it definitely will put you in some altered states. And I happen to have been on the fourth day of this fast, of this one of these 10-day fasts, when I had to record the solo for The Love of God.
Ah, well, you can hear it in there.
Yeah, and, but that, because the fourth day is the toughest.
Yeah.
After that, it actually gets easier. But there was other things we used to do. Like, for instance, I was fascinated with pyramids at one point way back. And I built this small replica of the Great Pyramid in Egypt based on the same dimensions, but just enough for me to sit under it.
Yeah.
And I recorded a lot of stuff under pyramid.
That's crazy.
Yeah, including For the Love of God.
Oh, my gosh. So you were 4 days into a fast.
Sitting in a pyramid.
In a pyramid. Well, when I go back to listen to that, I will be I'll be thinking that image will be forever emblazoned. I'm Tom Morello, and this is Maximum Firepower. My guest is guitar virtuoso and spectacular all-around dude, Steve Vai. Now, you mentioned something that was not on my little list, but we have to talk about it. I can't believe that I forgot, is the movie Crossroads. Because that was, again, it was a meteor for those of us. Like, there was no touchstone for that. I mean, we were fans of, you know, Randy Rhoads and Eddie Van Halen, but here's a guy we didn't even know. You know what I mean? Like, if like the way that, I mean, and this may be just sort of the way that the music industry works, but it's like, you knew of all the people who were were great guitar players because they were being marketed to, you know what I'm saying? And I'm like, that must really be the devil's guitar player. Crossroads, by the way, is a great movie with Ralph Macchio. Is that
Ralph Macchio,
who goes on this journey to the crossroads where this bluesman has sold his soul to the devil. He's trying to reclaim it, and it's an okay movie. But the last eighth of the movie is five stars because whoever plays the devil in it is fantastic. And Steve Vai is the devil's guitar player who goes up against Ralph Macchio. Now, what we all learned later was that you played both parts. You played both the complex classical parts that win, spoiler alert, that wins it for Ralph Macchio and your own as well. But now I played this for this movie. I showed this movie to my kids. My kids are now 10 and 11 when they were about a year ago. And one of them is, he's into pop music and hip hop, and he's just thinks that I'm absolutely ridiculous in everything that I do.
My kids do.
Absolutely ridiculous. My younger one is a guitarist and has an ear for this sort of thing, but they both were riveted by that scene. I got to say, there's a great sort of art in both the end of that movie. And now, where did that fall sort of on the timeline of your career? Was that before
Dave? Yes, because I was in Alcatraz at the time.
Yes, you were. I forgot. Yes. Yeah.
And the Attitude song had come out in a flexi disc in Guitar Player. And Ry Cooter, who was scoring the film, was looking for a guitar player, a hot shot.
Yeah.
So he called Guitar Player magazine and asked, hey, you know, I need a hot shot that can do this. And they played him the Attitude song over the phone.
Yeah.
Tom Wheeler.
and
he
got
said,
the
that's
gig.
The guy.
You got the gig. Yeah.
Yeah. And at first it was just to build a duel scene. And I read the script and I said, yeah, you know, I love theater.
Yes.
You know,
sure.
I'm a ham. I mean, the ham is cooking, you know, I'm a total like actor, performer, not actor, but you know,
yeah,
I'm a ham. And I read this script and I was like, I got this shit, man. I know exactly.
Yeah.
because what they were doing before that was, it wasn't working. They had all, you know, some other guys come in, but they were jamming.
Right, right.
You know,
right,
you can't,
right.
This is, it's theater. You got to make it like, you know, yeah. So I worked with Rye on that and it was just fantastic. Rye did all the slides.
That's right. That's right. And you did
and
all
I
the
did
technical
the other stuff.
Crazy stuff. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It was great fun. You know, it's another example of a part of a perfect storm. You can do a hit record. You can have a hit record, but being in a hit movie.
Yeah.
That changes everything.
Yes, yes, yeah. And it really, yeah, because everybody saw your face. And it was at a time where Ralph Macchio was really big in Karate Kid world. And so it had a lot of people's attention. And I got to say, the last eighth of that movie holds up really strong now. Yeah.
It's so funny. I hadn't seen it in decades. And I watched it not too long ago. And a while when I was putting The Passion and Warfare together because I used clips from it. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, who is that guy? what a so arrogant.
I was going to say, that guy is feeling himself in that. Yeah, he's ready to go. And it came across in a way that was very compelling. Yeah. Okay,
I was like that in my mind.
Yeah, well, it comes across, which is
fiercely confident.
Yeah. I mean, here's the thing, too, is like, it's sort of in my career as well. Like, my records that people heard came out in an era where no one played a guitar solo. But I spent my 8 hours a day learning how to play guitar solos with Steve Vai and Randy Rhoads and this, that, and the other. And so, like, and you did like the Zappa and the Berkeley world that informs, you know, when you then put on, you know, strap on the spandex, you're not just a guy strapping on the spandex. You're a guy that has a whole reservoir of stuff that people don't recognize is there, but you come across as an artist that's very different from those who are just have scratched the surface of learning how to tap.
Well, thank you, Tom. The funny thing to me is that you're interviewing me.
I'm a super fan, dude.
You're just such a great contributor to the guitar environment, aside from your incredible contribution as a musician and an artist. I mean, we're sitting here talking about me, but frankly, your contribution is unique. And I use that word in the true sense. I mean, it's unique. And when you say you sat and listened to me and we're practicing 8 hours a day, what that turned into is a form of creativity that has nothing to do with conventional solos. You broke the so creative and interesting and the energy. I mean, it was so interesting to me about you. Is it okay that I'm waxing on about you during the show?
Yeah, okay.
The thing that was so interesting to me is you're just such a down-to-earth, humble, intelligent, and, you know, politically motivated. And that's all just incredible, you know, because you're so humble and kind. But man, the energy that comes out of the riffs, that's so authentic and palpable, along with the uniqueness of what you've created on the guitar as, you know, at a time, it was another perfect storm. My perfect storm was supported by many other people who created great accomplishments that then offered them to me to ride along with, and I was able to contribute. You built the boat, you know, at a perfect time when you came out, when the band came out, and it hasn't stopped. You continue to evolve, doing more interesting, more colorful, more melodic, creative things. That the thing that I respond to the most in any artist is when I experience the unexpected in a way that I feel it came from a uniquely inspired place that only resides in them. Because everybody has the ability to be uniquely creative. You either need the courage or you need the ignorance. You need the blissfulness to not even know that you're doing it.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you just, I don't know. This is just what I'm doing, you know? And for whatever reason, your contribution has just been so powerfully unique. I mean, it is just unique.
Well thanks, Steve. I mean, that's
just also, I just want to say, it's really nice and it's very helpful for an artist to have someone like you supporting me, because you have been one of my greatest supporters in the guitar community in my entire career, and your voice carries.
Yeah.
So I appreciate
it's well deserved and well earned. All right, brother. Thank you so much, Tom. Steve. Until next time, take it easy, but take it.
Let foes of justice tremble.
This has been Tom Morello's Maximum Firepower.
Hear this episode again
or listen to past shows right now
on the SiriusXM app. Search Maximum Firepower.